This episode of The Moment is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, we'll give you your first $50,000 in transactions fee free. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/moment. And by The Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC. Watch Rachel as she breaks down the big headlines for the local threads that tie them all together. It's The Rachel Maddow Show, covering America one story at a time, weeknights at 9 Eastern, only on MSNBC. And by The Message, a new podcast series from GE Podcast Theater.
Hi, Nikki Tomlin here, and I'm the host of The Message. I'll be following a team of elite cryptographers as they decode a highly classified radio transmission. To sum it up, extraterrestrials. The Message on iTunes.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hey, this is The Moment. I'm Brian Koppelman. Thanks for listening. Okay, this is a big deal for me. Today's guest is the film director John Dahl, and some of his movies are The Last Seduction, Red Rock West, Kill Me Again, Unforgettable, You Kill Me. But also, John Dahl single-handedly just completely changed my life. If you're a screenwriter, you want to be a screenwriter, there's a binary thing. You either are somebody who has made movies, or you're not somebody who's made movies. And when John Dahl said that he would direct screenplay my partner Dave and I wrote, that changed my life and changed it forever. And that movie was Rounders, and the director of that film is here today, and that's John Dahl. Hey, man.
Hey.
How are you?
Good. Good to see you in this capacity.
Yeah, this is fun.
It's really good.
You know, it is true, John, that, you know, whatever it was 19 years ago, I remember you had these two movies that Miramax wanted you to direct,
mm-hmm.
and you chose ours.
Right.
So thanks for that.
Yeah, it was a good script. Still's a good script.
No, you taught me, I often say, and I didn't get to go to film school, and the first week of working with you in prep when we sat and refined the script, and then the first week actually on set making it, that was my film school.
Mm-hmm.
And you were so generous with your knowledge and thoughts on how to work creatively, on how to be kind of rigorous, hard on the material in yourself, and on the business. And why is that? Like, do you always consider that as part of your role to mentor the people that you work with?
It's a good question. I think at that point in my life when I had pretty much written everything that I'd worked on. I was really interested in directing, but I realized there's no way I'm going to get to direct anything unless I actually come up with the script.
Yeah.
So through that process of going from kind of an artistic career, a visual background, you know, music background, drawing, cartoons, you know, to kind of get my head around writing took years. And I really had to learn it. You know, I took mythology course. I mean, I kind of grabbed my hand because I figured I'm not really a writer, so I have to learn the craft of writing through reading a bunch of books. So when I got to doing Rounders and you guys, and I got to read this script and I said, wow, this is pretty good. It's kind of like a sports movie, but it's like with cards. And I love the dialogue and you guys are great at that. And so I think I was just so thrilled that I didn't have to write it.
That you were like, I'll be nice to these guys doing this work.
No, and also I guess I recognize that this, and I loved you guys' personal story, you know,
yeah.
which was fantastic. And you guys had kind of arrived at this moment. And I guess I just respected what you guys had gone through to get to that point. I mean, I'm just a guy from Montana that got lucky and got to be in the film business and has had, you know, wonderful opportunities. There's not a day that I don't get up that I have, you know, gratitude and respect for what I get to do. You know, I really appreciate the fact that I get to do this. So, I mean, I think that's just my general approach to life. So,
You have that kind of gratitude. And but you also have gratitude, but you have a keen awareness, and you did even then, of sort of, like, you have a great bullshit detector.
Right.
Don't you think that you're aware of sort of, like, the way?
Well, I think the one thing that I'm looking forward to is, like, when I don't do this anymore, I don't have to be self-critical. I mean, you've been doing this for years now, too, right? You always have to kind of watch what you're doing and say, is this good enough? I mean, there's a lot of people that want to get into the film business, but they don't know how to criticize themselves. They don't know how to take criticism constructively. And I think one of the things that helped me when I first got into film school is that I'd been in art my whole life and music. And you can't really do music or art without being criticized or constructive criticism, with, you know, your professor or whoever you're taking drawing lessons or, you know, for whatever. But for film students, there's a lot of people that have never had any criticism in their life. So they write this script. And then some dickhead professor goes, well, this is a piece of crap. And it just crushes them. They're devastated.
Yeah.
And they can never rebound from that. And if you think about that, the creative process, you know, you have to value effort, right? That's incredibly important. Somebody took the time to put this together. You can at least, you know, find something good to say about it. But then you also, if you know, you have to look at the person and say, do you want to hear what I really think?
Yeah.
And if they say yes, then I try to be, you know, respectful of that process. I mean, I've gone through that. I mean, you know, as a writer, if you can get one of your, like, I have a couple of friends that'll read a script and they'll tell me exactly what they think about it. And when you're in this business, you really, really appreciate that.
Oh, it's crucial.
You can get, what was it? The film critic had one of the best lines. The film industry is the only business in the world where you can get encouraged to death.
Yeah.
Is that Pauline Kael?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's true. And having that, I mean, I remember sitting with you at the Royalton Hotel in these high back chairs. And we did like 4 days in a row right before we shot the movie where you were really concentrating kind of on beginnings and ends of scenes. And I remember Dave and I loved all this sort of like clever lines that would end scenes. And sometimes you'd say, but don't you think the scene and your method of doing it was so great? Because you were like, look, I'll shoot, you know, you were the director and you were in charge. We were like, I'll shoot it like this because the way you came into it was through us and all this. You were super respectful of it, but you were like, but it just seems to me like if you would end the scene here, it would lead us into the next scene better. And you really taught us the difference between sort of like the script you write for yourself and then the thing that you're going to go and sort of put all these people and resources and time and energy towards making.
Right.
Which I imagine wasn't easy for you to learn for yourself.
Well, I think at some point where, you know, in this process where you realize, you know, I just had sat at my desk or my computer and written some scene. And then now I'm standing on a, you know, in Nevada and there's 100 people standing around, you know, and we're constructing some scene that I dreamed up in my living room. And you realize how much effort everybody has put into being there and how that eventually that has to be transposed to now you're sitting in a screening room. You've wasted everybody's time, somebody's money, and now you're asking these 200 people to sit here and watch your story. It, you know, there's at some point, you know, I guess you realize that it has to service something other than just yourself and your own needs. And so I guess over the years I've learned that if I keep asking myself questions and if I talk to people in a series of questions, if I talk to the actors in a, you know, you go into this scene and I'll just do my sort of Columbo. Actually, I shouldn't even say this, but.
No, I know. You can do it.
But I just find that.
No, you're Columbo. I don't run away from it.
No, I find that creative people like to answer questions. And if it's like, I guess it's a little bit like being an attorney. You kind of want to know the answer before you ask it, but you really want to. Nobody likes to be told what to do. I certainly don't.
So you want to elicit it.
Yes, exactly. And so if you can pull it out and it starts a creative process in that person. Where you say, you know, Brian, is this scene, you know, do you like this, the way this ends? You know, is this thing getting what you want, you know? And, you know, well, we like this button or, you know, whatever that is. And sometimes by that conversation, we realize, you know, we've already kind of accomplished that. And this happens all the time in filmmaking. You know, you write a line, we go out and shoot it, you see it, and you realize, you know what, we've said that thing, the same thing 4 times in the movie. We don't need to say it again. We got it. Because there's the visuals, there's the actor's face, there's an emotion, there's an expression. And it's a difficult thing to translate, you know, a page to a image. And some, you know, to get that, I mean, it's a very different thing, writing a script. You know, getting it out on paper. It's a whole process, as you well know. And then seeing that delivered on screen becomes a completely other process.
Yeah, and figuring out ahead of, it's figuring out ahead of time in a way where you're going to be able to allow the images to do the work is really challenging. And as you go, one of the big differences in being someone who has done this for a long time and at the beginning is now I know when I'm doing it that there are all these moments that if I'm shooting for 40 days, I know. The truth is, when the edited version of the movie is going to reflect about 30 days worth,
right? Right.
Shooting,
right.
Or whatever, 35. It's so hard to figure out the stuff you can, you know.
Well, I mean, you and David are very good at this. You guys are visual filmmakers, right? You know, you and you also write great dialogue and great character.
Thanks.
So When do you know if, like, that location is just the way you want it, the car is exactly the way, you know, the dirt on the fender is exactly the, you know, it's like the guy's car, you know, there's so many little elements that go into it that on some level as a writer, you're trusting that that's going to kind of be there. Or like it's or even as a director, it's like knowing which, what are the ingredients that really drama, what does this really have to be?
My guest today is John Dahl. We'll be right back after this short break. This episode of The Moment is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy mobile payments. Maybe you're working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub. Then why not use the same simple payment solution that helped them become what they are today? Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless. It's almost magical. Add it to your app with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. And if some other way to pay comes along, we'll support that too. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support means you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. To check it out for yourself, visit BraintreePayments.com/moment. That's BraintreePayments.com/moment. When did it first occur to you that you could live your life as an artist? Like that there was such a thing, that you could be an artist? Like how did that happen for you?
I mean, I remember this, you know, I remember I was maybe 7 years old and I saw the Beatles on television. And it just sort of changed my life. I thought, that's cool. That's what I want to do. I love the black and white. I love the music. I love the film, you know, Life magazine. I mean, just like I kind of got drawn into pop culture at that age. And another kind of thing that changed my life was when I was 15, I got my first band. I got my first drum set. Then I got my first band together. And I was kind of like the manager. So, you know, we got the songs together. And now you know what I'm talking about. Because I always had a band pretty much from the time I was 15 until I was 25. For like almost 10 years, I was always playing in some kind of band. And if you've ever been around musicians, as you have, you know, they're wonderful, but they're not necessarily, you know, schedule-oriented. Or, you know, it's hard to get them all together in the same room. And hard to get them to agree. And bands are just difficult. But through that process of dealing with a lot of difficult personalities, organizing everybody, getting us gigs, and then the most important thing was getting the check.
After the gig.
And I remember we also had this technique of we'd load the mic stands last because we'd drive out of the, you know, and play in little towns like Belfry and outside of Billings. And we'd put the mic stand on the door last so that if we needed it, you know, if we had a disgruntled customer or somebody that wanted to, you know, challenge us in some way because we're the band from the big city, we'd load up the one object that we could smack somebody with last. It just, you know, like, I mean, it wasn't that dangerous, but...
But you were thinking about that stuff.
We were thinking about that stuff.
I mean, you were thinking about, what if I have to handle this in a certain
way? Exactly. So, I guess that goes from being, I think, a Boy Scout, you know, so it was like, you know...
You were like preparing for emergencies.
Be prepared, yes. And we'd load everybody back up. We'd get paid. We'd go home. And I think that now you get into the film business and you're a film director and you go out the first couple of times and you realize, oh, we got to get this cinematography. I got the wardrobe. I got all this, you know, people that want to do these artistic things. You know, I got to get them all together, coalesce them into getting a scene and then photographing it. It's not that much different than
being in a band and managing the band.
Exactly. And so.
But how did you build? So that explains sort of like the getting a group of artistic people together and being able to marshal their resources to have a unified purpose and a unified sound or a unified visual field. You know what I mean? That makes sense.
Right.
But when did you start realizing, okay, I love to play music, but I also see the world in a very particular filmic sort of a way? Like, you saw a movie that changed your life or you... Because the Beatles was one thing, and then what was the second piece?
The next big thing, I was at the... Motor View Drive-In in Billings, Montana, and I took a date to see this movie that I'd heard about called Clockwork Orange. Not exactly the best date movie.
That's a weird choice.
Yeah, well, you know.
As long as you didn't bring milk out after.
No. And we didn't really watch the movie that much because it was a drive-in, so the next night I went back and watched it by myself.
Oh, because something caught... You mean caught you got enough attention?
Yeah.
Something caught your eye.
And, you know, I'd never really seen anything like it where you had Beethoven... played over like a completely violent scene. You had this contrapuntal music going. And then I was an art student and music, and I loved all the artwork. I loved the fact that the cost, it just got my attention because there was nothing on the images that wasn't controlled by the filmmaker. And I remember thinking, somebody had to make all of this stuff. Somebody had to design all of these things. You know, there was an object in the film that was, you know, the artwork was integral to the movie. You know, there's the whole style of it and, you know, this sort of like, you know, gangster-like quality, this, you know, not unlike a rock band in a way.
And you hadn't read the book.
Never read the book. Just saw the movie.
Saw the movie and realized there was some hand behind this making every decision.
And that got my attention. I think I was 18. That
already playing rock and roll.
Yep.
And then you saw this and you thought, did you think, like, I want to be a part of this? I want to be a director?
It was like the first time it ever occurred to me that somebody had to make this. And I just assumed that this stuff kind of got spit out and you watched it and that was it. And then I got out of high school. I went to art school for 2 years. I realized taking fine art, it's like, I don't know, how am I going to make a living doing this? I have no idea.
So the practical side did kick in a little bit.
The practical side kicked in. I worked as a commercial artist for a little while.
Were you seeing a lot of movies? Like, so after Clockwork Orange, like, I remember for me when I saw She's Gotta Have It.
Right.
And Raising Arizona.
Right.
To get, like, they came out within a short time where I was at college. I saw them both in the theater. And that those were the first things that kind of made me think, oh, holy shit. Like, language, because, you know, those are both the dialogue in those movies. Spike Lee and the Coen brothers wrote dialogue like nobody else.
Right.
And something just turned sideways in me when I saw those things. I was like, well, how is that possible? Like, that, you mean they can think of those words and then they can use them in that way and then they can shoot those images? And, But yes, then that tumbled me into seeing just tons of movies. You know, suddenly you wake up. So, like, that's what I'm saying. You were in Montana. Like, by the time I was in college, I was in Boston. I could... There was so much more out there for me to go see. What did you do after you saw Clockwork Orange?
Well, the thing is, I mean, I kind of grew up in the 70s. So, I mean, Cool Hand Luke was a studio movie.
Sure.
You know, The French Connection, Godfather. Now, most of these movies I got to see once in the movie theater, but they were so impactful.
But when you were in the art school, though, and was it a big deal to movies?
You know, when I was in at the University of Montana, they would play movies, and we would go see them. But I wasn't really thinking about being a filmmaker at that point.
Did you love them?
Totally.
Or it mattered to you?
Yeah, Oh, totally. So then I started going to Montana State because I realized, wow, they got a film program. Because, in some way, I always knew I wanted to move to California. I think I was like 12 or 13. I thought, you know, I'm moving to California as soon as I can.
Where do you think that came from?
I have no idea, you know.
You can't go back and find it. Like, you don't know, you saw an image.
I think it's just like that, you know, kind of addiction to pop culture, you know.
Yeah.
Those things really, you know, excited my imagination. You know, art, drawing, music, you know, color, you know, those kinds of things really just, you know, kind of got under my skin at a young age. And California seemed like it was where everything was happening.
Sure.
So, after a couple of years of art school, I applied to a commercial art school in Pasadena. I didn't get accepted, probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because I was an okay artist. You know, like a lot of directors, we're really not very good at anything in particular, but we're good at telling other people how they can maybe do it. And so I thought I would get in by animation. And then once I started doing animation, that's where I really got sucked in and drawn into filmmaking.
Because you went to L.A. to do animation?
No. I thought, well, I'll go to film school. And when I got to film school and I started looking at...
Where's that AFI?
Montana State
before AFI. Because then you went to AFI later, right?
Yes.
So you're at Montana State and you're in film school then. I just want to get the... Because I always find the path that people take. Because you're as a commercial artist, and at that time, I'm sure when you first start that, you think, well, okay, this seems like a career that combines a bunch of my interests.
Right.
But then you got something in you just felt like, oh, it's not enough?
Yeah.
I need more.
Yep. Because I go back to the band experience because I'm an okay musician, but I'm not great. And I think that was kind of one of the crushing things in life is realizing I'm not that good at music. You know, I'm really just not. And so it's like that, there's not a career for me here. I mean, I've got a guitar sitting in my living room. It's been there for 30 years. I don't, you know, it's like, have I ever written a song? Not one that I'd sing to anybody. You know, they're just terrible.
How often do you write them?
Not very often because I'm not very good at it. You know, it's like at some point you stop trying, you know, but
I still try. I still write them. I do. I can't help it. I still write them.
Yeah. But, well, you would, I mean, you're good with words. I mean, I would imagine it's, you know.
Yeah, so, I don't know. No, I just still, I don't know why. I can't give it, like, I still write them. No, I'll go through bursts of it. I have to write like 7 songs. Then maybe I won't for 6 months. Then I'll write another, I don't know.
Would you ever play one for anybody?
Yeah. Oh, because good. I can deal with embarrassment better than you. You don't like being, you know, I'm fine. Like, I can handle it.
Yeah.
But so you realized, okay, this music thing, I'm not great at it.
Right.
So then you get this responsible job of being a commercial artist.
So then, I've got to somehow make a living. You know, that's a practical side. And I also think, you know, my father was in the insurance business. I grew up in a family with, you know, my dad was in business. My sister was a partner at Deloitte Touche. My other sister's an engineer. My brother's also in this business. But, you know, there was, you know, like I knew I was going to have to get make a living somehow. I'm not going to just be able to go to school and be a freeloader on my parents', dime. So the film business, you know, seemed like a way that you could combine, you know, creativity and artistry and, you know, maybe make a living. And I think that was at a young age, I realized, you know, if I would be thrilled if I could just make a living being in the arts. You know,
you did. So you had that conscious thought.
There was that conscious thought. And interestingly enough, I was maybe four years ago, I was back in Billings. My dad, he just celebrated his 93rd birthday.
That's awesome.
He's a World War II veteran. And all these veterans would get together and have coffee. And I went with him one day, and there was a local artist in Billings, Leon Pomeroy, does metal sculptures. Grew up on, you know, he was born in a log cabin, and I think he was 88 at the time, and he said the same. He said, I said, really, I love your sculptures. How did you, you know? He said, well, I just grew up. I thought if I could make a living being in the arts, that would be the ticket. And I don't know where that comes from, but that was a goal of mine.
But in a way, that's like a modest goal and also like a great dream, sort of a great way to think about it, right? You didn't say I have to dominate it or I have to be a director.
No, I was just like,
I want to be around artists and be, you know, in some way.
Yes.
And your folks, were you encouraged to do that? Was it
not really? No.
So, well, did you tell anybody?
Well, no. Their feeling was like, well, that's great. You want to do that, John? Maybe you could get a job as an art teacher. You know, because that, you know, that was the way that you could make a living.
Yeah.
You know, you can do your art, but somebody's going to pay. You know, the school, you know, is going to pay you to do this.
So part of that must have appealed to the practical side.
I think that's also been a great asset to me because I've always respected the fact that this is a business. People put down a lot of money to make these projects, and I've always respected the fact that, you know, these people put that money into this process. I feel responsible for that, and feel like I have to spend that money wisely and be prudent.
Well, you say that, and I know that that's true. In other words, you're not somebody who goes over, but you're not profligate on the set. You know, you're very responsible.
Right.
If you're going to shoot the thing in 12 and a half hours, if that's what you have.
Right.
But certainly on the feature film side, I've watched you have pitch battles with people who are paying for the thing over what you feel like are the important creative issues. So
I say that here, but, you know, it's like you get into that moment and we just have to have that, you know, and I try to wear two hats. I think probably one of the, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, I think one of the best things that I've figured out about the film business is that, and it's made it a lot easier, is that no movie, no show that I'm shooting is ever about me. I mean, I might be the director, but one of the great things is to be able to take the burden of it all being on me and then like lift it up and sort of put it on everybody. And I'm never talking about myself. Look, we're here because we believe in this material. We believe this script is a good project. How are all of us going to make it better? You know, so making the argument that it's based on the screenplay. How do we lift this up, make it as great as we can, and we all participate in it, and try to taking yourself out of the equation. So once you start to do that, and then you say like to the executives in charge, what was it that that appealed to you? What is it that you love about the material?
Yeah, going back to the why.
You think that this is important. Why are we spending time and money and all these people's efforts on this? Well, we think this is important, and then you're on one of those arguments where it's time and money, because it always is. Look, we all agree that this is important. Subtext, that was your idea. And, you know, you value that. So how do we lift this up and accomplish this? And maybe we, you know, it's a budget. Let's spend here and we'll save here, you know.
Yes.
And so it's like, you know, making it a team effort as opposed to it's all about me and my script and this is, you know, yeah. and your personality and your the cult of person. And there's a lot that goes, there's a lot of that.
There's
the
a lot of that. And you've always been really good at, I remember early on one of those things in that couple of week film school that you put us through, which you said a great tool is you just keep telling the story of the movie over and over again to everybody. Instead of about yourself, you just keep saying, or the story, or the yeah. script or whatever it is, you just keep saying, No, I hear your objection, like why you don't think we should shoot this at night.
Right.
And I get that it'd be more expensive and everyone has to stay up. The thing is, you know, this is about this guy who goes out at night. You know, we meet him and then he goes out at night and plays car. And this is the story you're... And then you go, you just tell it over and over again and then they start saying it.
Yeah.
And then once they start saying it, they'll kind of... It'll be their idea to give you what you need to do it. But there's also... you also do have the ability to be, like, stubborn in a good way and insistent.
Well, and that stubbornness would be, I can afford myself that if I completely believe what we're doing.
You mean if it's not about you, if the stubbornness is about the
Look,
story you're trying to tell?
This is a better shot if we do it this way.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a lot easier to, you know, lead the troops into harm's way if everybody's behind you. But if you look back and you're the Lone Ranger,
yeah.
it's, you know, so it's, it, you know. I mean, part of filmmaking is consensus building, and one of the things that I really like about the film business, as having been like I think working as a commercial artist for, you know, about 9 months, I didn't like sitting at a table all by myself. You know, that's what I missed about my band experience. I like the fact that okay, so maybe the guitar player is a little you know maybe he missed a practice, maybe he was off with his girlfriend, you know, but I still liked it when he showed up, and I liked being, you know, I loved all the complications of those personalities, and I liked what we did together, right? So being sort of like the Lone Ranger at a desk
for you didn't
wasn't enough. And so what I love about the film process is I love that you bring all of these people together, and I mean, I have like the greatest job. I mean,
yeah.
I just spent 2 days watching Paul Giamatti just tear up the scenery. It was just
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's priceless.
Yeah, no, because you're directing our show Billions. Yeah.
and to get like the, I mean, he's, you know, been one of my favorite actors for years. So then to get this like front row seat to that kind of thing and to watch what all these talented people, you know, can bring.
Well, and to marshal them. I mean, you're marshaling their resources to serve the story you're trying
right.
to tell.
Right.
This episode of The Moment is brought to you by The Rachel Maddow Show. Every weeknight, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow breaks down the big headlines for the local threads that tie them all together. Sure, that's a lot of searching and it takes a lot of work. But even in a country this big, there are no local stories. Your life and what you see from your front porch is directly connected to the national news. Watch Rachel as she connects the dots and covers America's news one story at a time. It's The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern, only on MSNBC. I watch it most nights. Most nights, I'm watching The Rachel Maddow Show. You should watch too. Let's get back to how, because a lot of people I think are somewhere like Montana. I just realized through you talking a second ago what the one thing growing up in New York robs you of is the possibility to dream about living somewhere else.
Because this is it.
I never realized
yeah.
it before.
Yeah, yeah.
That's you don't like of course you know because you said oh this idea yeah. of California. I mean maybe yes you could think L.A. for Hollywood.
Yeah, it's like that Alicia Keys song that.
Yeah.
And then there's the rap, you know, it's yeah. like, that's it.
And so growing up here, you don't think to yourself, oh, if I could only, because you're, it kind of, it's an interesting thing.
It takes that dream away.
That dream yeah. just doesn't even exist. So I looked at you like, oh, really? You were 12 and you thought I want to be somewhere else? Because
yeah.
that just never, it never occurred, you know, it just couldn't have yeah. occurred to me.
Yeah.
And I see my kids, they can hardly imagine, you know, getting my son to go somewhere like when he realized he was going to go out of the city to go to college.
So. Right. And that's a big step. I mean, I think, you know, to be able to move someplace and exist there and then come back. I mean, it just gives you a perspective.
It is. But so how did you get yourself? So you're there. You're in this job, commercial artist. You go to Montana State to do film.
And then I realize I have to put away the paintbrushes and the pencils and I have to learn this entirely new trade. And it was exhausting and frustrating at first.
Learning, because you were a storyboard artist at first. So
I drew cartoons. Later I sort of circled that back. So now,
the new craft you mean was animation?
I wanted to be, you know, because I'd always drawn cartoons like a
yeah,
comic.
You're good
book.
At drawing, yeah.
Yeah, and so now I get into film school and it's cameras and stories and all this brand new stuff, and I'm excited by it, and I'm watching all these movies, and I'm, you know, film history class, which was great, like learning the history of film, history of documentaries. I mean, it was just, it was incredibly exciting. And then learning this new craft, and then and at first I thought, you know, I want to be a cameraman because I could take pictures. Then everybody in my film class at Montana State, there was 9 people, I think, and almost everybody wanted to be a camera person. I realized, well, I've drawn cartoons, and then I could draw these pictures, and then all I have to do is photograph the pictures. I mean, this is how my... So we were doing one of our early projects, and I just basically drew a storyboard out of, you know, and pretty much shot the storyboard, and then realized... Now I just have to figure out how to write, you know, because I can...
But then you realized I could write this and then I could actually make movies.
Yeah. Yeah. And so...
And that was animated, though. Still then you thought, write an animated movie, or that's when you then thought...
No, that's when I started. I mean, once I got to film school, I just sort of dropped animation.
Right. You realized...
I realized, you know, it's, you know, photography, images, you know, it was... I liked cartoons, but you know, I love movies, so...
Yeah. So then you started doing that. You realized, oh, I can do this because I can composition. I'm good with people, so I can organize them. And so that's when the thought started, like, I could maybe become a director?
Yeah. And so those things started to kind of sprinkle in, and realizing now I need a story to tell, and you know, what are those stories that what I would do is I would make my own films with my friends on the weekends, and we just shot these Super 8 films.
Did you take it seriously?
Yeah, well, you know, as serious as you do when you're 20
years
old.
Well, but no,
yeah,
you would think about the story you wanted to tell, have to get people
props,
together,
get the people, and most they were like little silent 3 to 5 minute shorts. And then we had this other great thing, which was incredibly valuable, is I was on the Film Society. There was like 5 of us. We'd pick the movies that we were going to show for the quarter, and then, you know, we'd project them. So I'd have this projector. We'd be showing like Red Desert, you know, like we'd bring in these foreign films. Then I'm sitting there and I realize I've got this audience of people that are sitting here. Why don't I show one of my stupid little 8mm films as the short before the film?
You did.
I totally did that. And so people would come in, the lights would go off, and then we'd show our 8mm film with music. Again, it was one of the best experiences because now I'm sitting there and I can see where people are just, you could see where they started to get bored. And then the other kind of great thing that I learned from that was that it's one thing to make a movie and then watch it with your friends or show it in school, but it's another thing to show it to an audience because something changes in your head.
Yeah.
Because now all of a sudden you become self-conscious of, oh, that's right. If I want all these people to come here and see it, this can't be about me anymore. This has to be about the experience of watching this. And any filmmaker, any director wants to get as many people into a room and show them something. And get them to appreciate, you know, see what you saw in it.
And so you were immediately getting to a place when you would show those little movies. You could immediately be rational enough to go like, and analytical enough to say, okay, let's figure out what works and what doesn't. Like that happened to you instead of being, I can imagine me just being crushed at first in the beginning. So you didn't have that experience of feeling bad. You were just like, how can I make this better?
I thought, exactly. And I'd go home and I'd...
How are you built that way?
I don't know. I wouldn't try to, you know, because maybe that's from being... playing music in front of an audience, and the guy going, people are sort of bored now.
Like you're drumming.
We should end this song. Let's not do the long solo anymore. You know, if you're in front of a live audience, and I think that's part of what is missing for, you know, a film school experience is because, I mean, you remember the test for Rounders. I mean, it's a full-on combat sport to go test a movie with an audience. And I think... When we were doing Last Seduction, the editor would say, let's watch the movie once a week. You know, we'd get, you know, the editors and, you know, anybody we could drag off the street to come in and we'd watch the, you know, because thing is, as you know, you change a scene at the beginning, it can affect how the movie ends. So it's a good idea to kind of constantly be monitoring where you're at.
Yeah, we show stuff all the time to people because now I don't get crushed at all. I only get... You know, it's the same thing every time you put it together. The first time you watch it, there's another thing you taught me, that the first time you watch the thing that you've made, you hate it. No, all you see is the bad parts.
Right.
So you know that now. So like now, 20 years on, I can watch it. I go, oh, okay, that's just how I'm going to react.
Right.
Then I can...
then you can watch it.
Then you watch it again and you're fine. You know, you're fine.
And think about what you're doing there. You're sort of removing yourself from the emotional part of it.
Absolutely.
And you're starting to look at it more objectively and you're saying, okay, how do we... make this a better experience for the audience.
Because only a couple ways you can process that. If you're like, if you're a delusional person, you watch the first time and you're like, I'm a genius. But if you're a normal person, the first, you know, or like not the first time you watch, you just watch it and you say like, I had really thought this time I had a chance to make it good.
Right.
I really thought. Oh man.
Oh, it's crushing. My first film, Kill Me Again. We shot it, we cut it together, and we watched it, and it was probably like 3 hours long. And I remember sitting there at a screening room at Paramount Film Studios, because back then you had to have a 2 tracks projector, so you couldn't just watch it anywhere. And I remember watching it and going, that was pretty good. That turned out pretty good.
You did?
Yeah.
The 3-hour cut?
That, well, you know what it's like.
Yeah.
It's like when you finish writing a script, right? When you finish that and before anybody's read it, you know, you have that one moment of peace where you kind of go, wow, we did it. It's down on paper. You know, maybe, well, we used to print them out and we kind of go,
Yeah.
And you'd go home that night and you'd feel really good. And then now the next day, somebody's going to have to read it. And now the process starts where you just start and you have to elicit that.
Oh, yeah. I will say that is still the time. That's still when I'm delusional is when. So, you know, Dave and I write most of these things together, but we split scenes up. So Dave will write a bunch of scenes. I'll write a bunch of scenes. And so I've learned that the 12 hours following when I write a scene that I really had a good time writing, you better not fucking criticize. Like, for those 12 hours, I am sure.
You're on cloud nine. Yeah,
well,
you're floating.
Yeah, I'm positive that I'm, you know, David Mamet and...
Yeah, best thing ever written.
It's Barry Levinson combined. You know, it's just... And it's so funny because, like, Dave could call me, you know, we're going to send me an email. If he sends me an email 6 hours after I've put something in the Dropbox, that's the thing. Yeah. And he's like, you literally go, that's great. I cut those 2 lines in the middle, obviously, and I could write back like, "Are you cut those 2? Those are the best. The whole reason I wrote the thing. I got up this morning to write those 2 lines."
Yeah.
But if I'm left, but just give me 12 more hours.
Yeah.
In the morning, I'd be like, "Oh, I hope you didn't read that yet. There's two lines that really shouldn't be in there." You know, you immediately know, but in the beginning, it's hard.
And that's part of what gets you to that point. So you have to kind of respect that sort of exhilarating feeling of that artistic discovery of allowing 100%. Yourself to get to that point. I mean, I remember the first movie I did, I would be like obsessing over, we got to find this like bar location. And the location scout would kind of go, well, what bar? I said, you know, the bar where he comes in and he does that. And then I realized, oh, we cut that like months ago. But it was like this limb, you know, it's like the phantom limb.
Yeah, the atavistic thing.
Because that creative process that gets you through the birth of a script, it's so all-encompassing sometimes you lose yourself. And then that's the fun thing about filmmaking is that it gets smacked right back into your reality because you show up and there's 8 trucks, 120 people. How do you want to do this? What's that? And then reality sets in.
No, and then you have to get better at collapsing that time period, and you can.
Yes.
Right? You can. I mean, I'm joking about it being like 24 hours, but you do have to sort of recognize, you find a way, you have to have all the ebullience, right? And that you have to really be a dreamer to create the thing. And then, like you said, then you have to be rigorous and beat the shit out of yourself to make it good. And you have to be able to access both, right?
Exactly. And part of that is knowing that eventually it's going to be sitting in front of an audience.
Yeah, I mean, that gets into a conversation of like identifying who the audience is for a particular thing. So that if you're asking for $100 million, I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
If you scraped up $125,000, it's a different audience that you're talking about trying to make the thing for.
Yeah.
And that audience may be much closer and more reflective to your, if it's very personal.
Yeah. Well, one of the You Kill Me, this small little feature film.
Ben Kingsley.
It's like $4.5 million. I think it was $4 million.
Yeah, today you'd make it for $400,000.
Yeah, but it was a small movie, and everybody knew that. Last Seduction, we never, you know, that was a small movie.
Well, I don't want to jump ahead because I do have big questions about Last Seduction and Red Rock West, and sort of what the experience of making those movies and the initial reception versus the long-term reception and how that changed your sort of view of experts. But I want to understand how you got from Montana State, where you're making these little movies, to finally to California. Like, what happened?
So I remember sitting and getting ready to graduate from school, and one of the professors said, so went around the class and said, well, what are you going to do when you get out of film school? And I said, I'm going to go to Hollywood and become a feature film director. And he just laughed. And
really?
Yeah.
That's just fantastic.
There's not a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of support in the creative arts, you know, for, but I think part of why I was naive enough to think that I could do that, I didn't look at the limitations. You know, I only saw kind of what I, you know, I had this sort of course that I wanted to chart. And how do I do that? And
Had you saved a little money from, did you work during that time?
No, not really. So I went home to Billings and I worked, I got a job, you know, directing little tiny television commercials in town. I did that for a while. Then Dave Warfield, who was in film school with me, was working in the Washington, D.C. area on a small children's television show. And so I went out to D.C., worked as a grip for a couple of days, and then realized I didn't want to just, you know, I was basically a human sandbag because I was worthless as a grip. But they needed an assistant director. And this was back in the days when they had those strip boards, you know, the now it's all computerized. But
oh, yeah, you mean to schedule?
To schedule.
Yeah, you would have like these strips that you would put in order of the scenes that you were shooting. You'd move them around.
Right. So you could kind of begin to have a dialogue about how you're going to organize all this work.
You can kind of see a depiction of that in State in Maine, I think.
Yes, yes, yeah. So I had one of those, and I realized that the production was looking for another assistant director. So I went into the office and said, you know, I know how to schedule a show. And I'd actually worked on a television show while I was in college in Montana. And I sort of bullshitted my way into getting the job as the assistant director, and which was great. Again, a fantastic learning experience, because now I'm location scouting with the directors and... And I'm going to blank on his name, but there was this one director, and this was a fascinating experience. He would always take the script, and we'd go look at a location, and he'd say, "Well, the actor has to walk in that door. They have to come over here to the window. They have to look out and see the car on the street, and then know they're in danger, and then they have to run down the back staircase." So he'd basically have that script with him. We'd walk into the location, and he says, "Well, there's no window to look out onto the street."
Right.
So how are we going to shoot that?
And you would watch this process.
And so, I mean, I've done that, and I just thought, wow, that's, you know, because, location scouting or like picking location, I always look at it like an actor, because the last thing you want to do as a director is have the actor walk in and say, I was supposed to go look out the window. There's no window.
Right.
How do I do that? You know, that's a disaster.
Well, yeah, just all I'm thinking about now is State in Maine again, which is like the show's called The Old Mill that they're making.
Mm-hmm.
And then the town, they change towns, and the screenwriter shows up, and he's like, "Where's the mill?"
Right. Because
the whole thing is, and there's no mill in the town.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Wait, there's no mill?"
Yes. Well, this the first script that Dave Warfield and I wrote. It was this low budget film. They were shooting it in Hollywood, and there was supposed to be a dust storm in this old Hollywood Western town. And we get there, and there's no dust storm. We can't manufacture the dust storm, and then the producer says, "Well, doll, this doesn't work. How this guy'd see him right here?" Yeah, but because there's supposed to be a dust storm.
Where's the dust storm?
And then the actors are going, "This doesn't." You know, it's like, well, yeah, of course it doesn't. We have to have anyway. It was a disaster.
It's maddening.
Yes,
maddening.
Exactly.
So what was the show that you were working on? What's the show that you were assistant directing on?
It was called Powerhouse,
and it was a local.
It was local. The Department of Education had put this together, and. This small kind of documentary.
Did you get to direct any of them?
No. I asked them to, and they said, "No, are you kidding?" But and then I probably said, "Well, you know what? I'm going to go to Hollywood and become a director." Yeah,
right.
You know, I was pretty driven, probably kind of an obnoxious kid. I mean, I remember moving a few years ago, and I found some letters that I'd written, and I was just so obsessed with becoming
So once you got it in your head, you're like watching tons of movies and thinking about it and writing. Were you writing every day?
I was writing all the time.
Because you knew I have to find a way to become a writer.
I got to write a script.
And did you do that in Montana or when you came?
I started in Montana. I wrote several, you know. So I worked in D.C. for a while, went back home. I thought, if I can't be a director in the film business, I'm going to do something else. So I applied to the American Film Institute and I applied to law school. I got accepted to both, and I thought, well, maybe I'll go to the film school instead. And
it's great. So you mean you almost gave it up?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. You mean you did a couple years. You said you were this driven and obsessed.
Yeah. So I for like a year out of film school, I realized, if I'm not doing what I want to in this business, then, I guess there was that practical side of me.
but also like being an AD kind of sucked after you learned what you wanted to learn, right?
Right.
Then it was boring for you.
Yeah, it was great because I learned sort of the nuts and bolts of filmmaking. It was a fantastic experience. Then going to the American Film Institute and I think, you know, when you're talking about movies that sort of changed your life, I was sitting at the AFI. It was a big deal for me to move to Los Angeles. I'd never been in a city that huge before. I'm at the American Film Institute, and they showed Double Indemnity, the Billy Wilder film.
Of course, yeah.
Great movie, but now all of a sudden I'm living in the town where they, you know, I think there was a reference to like a street in Los Feliz. One of the woman lived in Los Feliz. And I'm living like four blocks from that neighborhood. I'm going to school in the neighborhood where they shot it.
Yeah.
And I become, all of a sudden, I realize, again, it was that idea that Billy Wilder actually stood on these streets and filmed scenes and shot stuff right here in Los Angeles. The Aldo Nido Hotel, which is in Sunset Boulevard, is still there. It's at the top of Gower. It's where William Holden lived when he was a struggling writer. I mean, to drive.
And so you saw all that and it got you.
And it just kind of go, you know, this somebody made these things right here. And then I started thinking, you know, for my first film, you know, I'd written maybe three or four, five, maybe even five scripts. Maybe
so you'd written five or six scripts that didn't get made.
That were all crap, yeah. One was good enough to get me an agent. And then we spent like months driving around, going to meetings, you know, pitching others. The worst pitch ever was the first time Dave and I went to pitch a movie. We had written this kind of a comedy. We'd written it was a comedy called General High School. It was a, you know, bad high school comedy, like kind of General High School soap opera. So our writer had
like General Hospital, but only in high school.
Yeah, sort of a soap opera high school thing.
This is the first time General Hospital is going to be in the show notes for this show. That's great.
So then our agent sends us out, and we're trying to write comedies, and we have this idea because there used to be mud wrestling in Los Angeles. So we thought, well, that is strange. We never went inside it, but we thought, okay, actress comes to Hollywood, wants to be an actress, but she turns in, you know, she becomes a mud wrestler instead. I'm so fortunate this movie didn't get made, but
the mud wrestling place was on Western and Sunset.
Exactly. So, but our first pitch meeting in Hollywood, we drive over to Paramount Studios, we walk in, and we pitch our show called Mud Dance. And it's kind of like Flashdance.
Mud Dance? That sounds like it's out of a Christopher Guest movie.
It's awful. So the lady listens to us for about 10 minutes, and we're saying, you know, the thing about Flashdance that was so just absurd is, like, I don't buy the fact that a ballerina could be a welder at the same time. I like, you know, it just, I don't buy it, but like a mud wrestler and an actress, I get.
That's what the person said. That was our pitch.
Well, then she looked at us and she said, you know, this company, we made Flashdance. Yeah, and so, I mean, our pitching skills
weren't the best at it, maybe.
Not at all. Never.
It's good to know that ahead of time.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's like that commercial where the guy keeps calling the guy interviewing him Mr. Dumbass, because that's what the sign says. And then at the end of the interview, the person says, Dumas. It's good to go in knowing, you know, of what it is.
Yes.
By the way, just because of the show notes, I want General Hospital to be right next to the Tropicana, which was the name of the mud wrestling place on Western and Sunset. Yeah,
exactly.
It's called the Tropicana.
It's not there anymore, I don't think.
Hi, Nikki Tomlin here, and I'm the host of The Message. I'm going to take you into an elite cryptography think tank and check it out. Their top project right now is to decode a highly classified radio transmission from the 1940s.
Have you listened to it yet?
Not yet. We're having a discussion about that. But if I offered you the chance to listen to it right now... Sounds like a no.
Well, we don't really know what it is. Voices, music, breathing. But, you know, I'm not going to mess with that thing.
To sum it up, extraterrestrials. Subscribe to The Message on iTunes.
So then you're driving around trying to pitch these things, writing these things. So how did your first real...
back to Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity. I think it was the idea that you could make... You know, I'd been kind of thinking about these stories, and I don't know, this one story of somebody that's really basically trying to escape their life and create a new life, you know, maybe like a guy from Montana, but... the idea that, and I think it was the thing that got under my skin was Double Indemnity. I never thought that the insurance business could be that sexy. My dad was in the insurance business. You know, it just kind of combined everything. The fact that it was made in Los Angeles, started thinking about this story. Well, actually, Dave and I had written another script that was like a horror film. We had to change the title of it because I think we were calling it Silent Night. Somebody put out a movie with that title, and we were like riffing on names. Well, let's come up with a different name. Kill me again. It just struck us as so odd. How do we do that? And then just to jump back for a moment, when I was a graphic artist and when I was at school in Missoula, I remember seeing all these books that had these like great Pulp Fiction covers. Like I Wake Up Screaming, those kinds of like just gripping titles. So when we accidentally stumbled across this title, Kill Me Again, it's like, how do we get somebody to kill somebody again in a movie? And then we sort of like that story started to just sort of roll out of us because now we'd been doing this for
years. Oh, you can feel all of that stuff in the movie. I mean, you can feel all that sort of excitement of those pulpy books and those covers. The movie does feel like the cover of one of those.
Yeah.
You did succeed at doing that. I mean, I've talked about that. I know you would have loved a shot to go make that movie again.
Right. Yes.
Actually, right?
Yeah.
But it does have these great moments in it where it's clear, oh, this is a real director.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure to get from that 3-hour cut to the one that exists.
Yes. Well, that was the fascinating. So now I just watched this is really great. And then the next day coming in, and the editor's going, well, you don't need this and you don't need that. And then realizing, oh, we're going to throw stuff out, because I directed some music videos, but I'd never done anything. I think I was probably the least experienced person on that.
So how did you learn to talk to actors?
When I was in college, I took acting. That's where I met Bill Pullman. It was one of my acting, taught me acting at MSC, Montana State, doing projects, and the American Film Institute. Great sort of directing classes there and working with actors. And so I wasn't that wasn't as complicated as managing all the logistics. I guess I wasn't prepared for like the professional actor in my first movie. That was challenging. But, just getting him out of the trailer sometimes. But those kinds
Mr.
of...
Mr. Kilmer.
Yes. Yeah. But those experiences, again, I guess I go back to my band days of like, how do I get the...
It's interesting, you throw the word professional, and I know that obviously Val Kilmer is a great actor, but his reputation at the time was difficult. I guess for you, it was difficult at times.
Right.
But being a professional is really important to you.
Right.
Right? Conducting yourself professionally.
Yes.
Is that, and you want that in the people around you on sets.
Right.
But it seems to me you probably were that way from the beginning of doing this, that you were going to approach it like that.
Well, as I kind of go through this process, I'll always say to the cameraman, well, let's do this like a professional production, or one of the things I'll use is like, if I was doing a student film, I'd do it this way, like describing a stunt. We could just drop the guy off of the chair, and into a pillow. But how are we going to do it? Because we're professionals.
We're making a professional show.
Yeah. So,
I guess what I want to ask you is, you go from that movie, Kill Me Again, and you said another one of those great things. You said, listen, Brian and Dave, you said to us, you guys will be able to get your first movie made as directors. No problem. The problem is getting a second movie made.
Yes.
You go, it's really hard. But I just wonder, because something I return to a lot is, and I've learned, is that the supposed experts are very often wrong about stuff because they're making decisions based on like a whole bunch of things that maybe don't have anything to do with whether something's really good or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you had this weird experience with Last Seduction and Red Rock West where you made those movies to be theatrical movies, and at first people didn't want to distribute them.
Right.
And Last Seduction in particular, how did you, which is a great movie, full stop, so is Red Rock West. And I'm wondering what it felt like to live this thing kind of twice in a row where you made a movie. I'm wondering if you knew it was really, really good. Then the people who were supposed to bring it to the world got cold feet, didn't do it. It kind of went out on TV at a time. People, not like now, when that was a sign of, it was really a disgrace in a way.
Yes,
And it was a real ding on your career, on your professionalism.
Right.
And then the things got discovered by critics and then audiences. And then they ended up getting to be released kind of backwards. what did you learn from the, first of all, was it painful to you? And second of all, if it was, like, how did you keep going and what did you learn from those experiences?
I guess early on, when I started thinking about being in the film business, I really didn't think I was particularly talented at doing this. But I did feel like I could work harder than anybody else. And I would put in more time and I would do more, you know, reading. I would do more. I would just work harder than everybody else. And I would just bury everybody because I would work harder. So when those setbacks came, and many of them, you know what that's like. It's crushing.
Yeah, it's crushing.
And then you get up the next day and you say, okay, let's start again. And I think the other thing is that if you've done it once before, I mean, I've done so many of these like climactic action scenes, and I remember doing like the first one that I did when I was in college. We made this our senior project. We had this kind of climactic action scene at the end of the show, and it took days to film. And you know, we went through the alphabet a couple of times, and there was just like one shot here and one shot there, and just kind of keeping it all straight in my mind. And nobody kind of wants to be there and get, you know, the actress can't be here because she's got an English class but I need the shot. And, you know, and I realized that, you know, we got through that, we made it, you know, and every time you have a big setback, you have to kind of think back and say, I did this once before, I can do it again. And it's kind of memory mapping. I mean, I was doing this TV show, yeah, a couple of years ago called The Bridge, where we closed down a bridge in Long Beach.
I love Elwood Reed, the creator, you know, yeah, co-creator, yeah, the guy who ran that show. He's a great guy from my...
And Matthew Lillard was in the scene, who's another phenomenal guy. But so we got this big climactic scene, five nights in Long Beach. We've shut down this entire bridge. We got, you know, 50 cars there. It's, you know, painfully expensive for the show. And at some point I'm thinking to myself, are we ever going to get this done? And having doubts, and then the odd thought, oh, wait, I did this in college. I can do this again. I've done this so many times in my life. You know, I mean, when you're making your own movies, there's that climactic action that you know is so important to the movie, and it never gets enough time scheduled on the schedule, and somehow you have to kind of pull it out of the fire. And no, it's that...
It drives you crazy. I was looking at... There's a moment in one of the episodes of Billions that... I remember we were shooting in two different spots. I had to go to one, spoke to the director of the episode. I was like, oh, this one thing is real important. Here's how you should get this. And the director said, yeah, I got it. I know exactly what, I'll cover it 20 ways. And of course, I went in the editing room last night and it's great. The episode is great, nailed. And this one thing just isn't.
Ah.
And it's a shot. Yeah. But I know, I was like, okay. I would have panicked a couple of years. And I went, right, okay. And I just said to the editor, it is funny how you learn. I go, great, can you give me a screenshot of that, which is the shot that it goes with, and then can you give me a screenshot of that?
Right.
And then, okay, we'll be back in that location in 3 weeks.
We'll just do it again.
And I can get that actor for the one shot, and I'll talk to the director of the thing, and I can show the screenshots, and then we can just put the camera here and sit him down and get that shot. So I do understand how you can build a story, like in another profession, like something that would have freaked you out and seemed impossible, you can just kind of close the time that you can solve it now, mm-hmm, because you have, like, experience.
Right.
But I'm interested in the emotional part of knowing you did something great. Like, Last Seduction is a great movie on a list of the best noir films ever made, with one of the singular performances by an actress ever. And when you had made it, and then those people didn't acknowledge what it was and didn't want to put it out, like, were you filled with rage, sadness? Like, how did you doubt that you'd done something great? Like, what did that time period feel like for you?
I think first I was grateful that I got to make the movie. Second of all, it was a script that I didn't write.
Yeah.
So I had some objectivity.
Oh, that gave you objectivity to know what was good.
And perspective. And I think that's where I started thinking, I think we made something good. And just back to Kill Me Again, and one of my first executive experiences, we had finished this movie. We show it to the executive that's in charge of the production. And he said, I enjoyed the movie, but there's that one scene where she says, you know what to do, Jack, kill me again. It's ridiculous, we've got to get rid of it. He walks out of the room. Are you shitting me? Right. That's the whole fucking reason we made the movie.
Yeah.
And I think, fortunately, the Steve and Yanni, the producers of it, and Warfield and I, we just said, we can't take that out.
No, right.
We just can't. We're not going to. And So, I mean, I'd been beaten up so many times by the time I did Last Seduction. I'd been just crushed and demoralized. And I remember after making my first film, I remember thinking, I had this analogy like, I'm on a football field, and my goal is to run the 100 yards to the other end of the stadium with two buckets of water. And there's about 50 people out there that are going to try to knock me over. And if I get to the other end of the field and I have any water in it left at all, I've succeeded. So, I mean, I wasn't really prepared for what it would be like to make a movie. It was absolutely crushing, demoralizing, walking, running, exercising, some level of frustration. I think when I was making Red Rock West, I had a punching bag in my garage. Yeah. I smacked the crap out of that many, many times.
Yeah. But you found a way each time to, I guess, get to the other end of the field with a little bit of water left.
Exactly.
And then you were able to, by defining it that way, you were able to, you said two things. You said, one, you got gratitude right away that you got to do it. And then you had a little bit of water left, and that was how you defined success.
And I guess I realized that I couldn't really define my success by what other people thought. I was defining my success by my own. One, I was making a living in the film industry so far. Two, I never expected any of it in the first place. I never expected to be welcomed as part of Hollywood. I mean, I feel like I've lived there for years, but I still meet people and they say, all right, I didn't know you lived here. I thought you lived in like Montana or something. No, I've been in LA for 30 years. I feel like such an outsider even to this day. And I just don't get caught up in all of that. I mean, I love what I do. To me, it's not really about the final product in a way. It's about what I get to do every day. It's in the moment. It's like, we shot a couple of great scenes this past week. It was so much fun to be there. And it's kind of like the environment that's it's living that moment on the set. It can become something completely other, when it goes to the editing room. By the time it goes through that big meat grinder of, executives and opinions and, it can become so many different things. So I try to just enjoy the moments that you have at the time, realize that I'm part of something that's making something and we're sort of birthing it and giving it to other people.
Wow, that's super inspiring. And and you're also still outworking everybody.
I'm trying to.
Well, you are. John Dahl, man, there was so much more I wanted to talk to you about, which is great for me because I get the next couple of weeks to keep working with you on Billions. But for the listeners, it ends here. Thank you so much for coming in and doing this.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for my career.
Hey, thanks for mine. It didn't hurt mine either.
And hey, you can find John, not really on social media, but you can find me there at Brian Koppelman at Twitter. Do you have a Twitter now?
No.
Yeah. He's from Montana. You know what? Honestly, he may live in Hollywood for 30 years. You're still from fucking Montana, Dahl. Let's be honest about it. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Hey, if you like the show, support it on social media. Tweet about it. Facebook about it. Leave reviews on iTunes. And let me know what you think. atthemomentbk@gmail.com. See you next week. The great John Dahl. If you've never seen The Last Seduction, Red Rock West, Kill Me Again, go see those movies. Don't listen next week if you haven't seen The Last Seduction. Actually, I still want you to listen, but I just wanted to kind of say that. All right, thanks, everybody. Bye.